Hey everyone, Johnny Anonymous here. Just wanted to let you know that after a long day of denying ignorance at the above top secret area, or denying apathy at the above politics area, I like to go to the below top secret arena and just have some fun denying boredom. It doesn't matter if I'm in the mood to just chit-chat with some of the other members and friends or share a good joke. I can do that and so much more in the below top secret forum. In fact, I just got a great recipe for marinating steaks in the food and cooking arena. It was so good that my lady friend just couldn't believe that I found it on that website. You found that at BelowTopSecret.com, she asked? Yes, my dearest, I replied. At BelowTopSecret.com, it's like a one-stop shop of fun and information. They've got areas like travel, health and wellness, music, literature, entertainment, art, and sports. They even have sections that you can rant in, talk about your faith and spirituality, learn about the coolest websites on the net, or even just talk about your latest relationship. Or maybe you're more into breaking news events, urban legends, or even an area that offers you some help on fixing that broken down DeSoto your dad has collecting dust in his garage. Well, friends, I've got to tell you that I've got her hooked, and now she and her friends all go to BelowTopSecret.com and hang out in the numerous areas on the forum. So if you're looking to deny boredom, maybe you should stop by www.BelowTopSecret.com and start having some fun, too.
Welcome to ATS Mix.
And I think until you start asking questions, you know, you're just going to buy whatever's offered to you on the 6 o'clock news.
ATS Mix.
This isn't a talk show, it's a freak show.
From AboveTopSecret.com.
But also be skeptical of the people who are out there selling conspiracy theories.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com.
In the name of Christ, just let us in.
Starts now.
Well, whether you like werewolves, black dogs about the size of small ponies.
I love the small pony black dog.
Loch Ness type sea creatures, Bigfoot, or UFOs. You're going to really enjoy our guest that we interview, who is Nick Redfern. And he's a wonderful man. We thoroughly enjoyed our time with him. And we think you folks are really going to enjoy our interview with him.
But before we fade into that, I just have to say thank you to two members that made it right underneath the deadline to ask Nick questions. Space Visitor, want to mention Space Visitor, and Mr. Gunter. The reason why we didn't ask your questions specifically is because before we got to going to the site and to try and ask your questions, he had already answered the questions. So it would have been kind of redundant. But I do want to make note, John, that we had Space Visitor and Mr. Gunter who participated in the questions for the author area that we had for the ATS Mix guest area.
And so now, here's our interview with Nick Redfern.
The following is an ATS Mix exclusive interview.
Well, Dave, it's not often that we get a chance to interview a guest who's actually pretty close to just being in your own neighborhood.
Yeah, in fact, Nick and I are probably 15 minutes maximum apart from each other. In fact, I even actually thought about maybe dropping over to his pad and, you know, we just do the interview from there. But, you know, don't have my equipment there, you know. So,
well, you know, there is a prerequisite. You have to bring the margaritas.
I have a rolling machine that's on wheel. I just roll it behind the vehicle, you know.
All right, well, let's get with it. The gentleman we're interviewing today, since 1978, his main goal in his research was to find out the UK's official level of knowledge in the field of ufology. By his efforts and hundreds of hours at the Public Record Office in London, he has uncovered literally thousands of pages of previously classified government and military files on UFOs. Nick has appeared and become a consultant on such channels as the Sci-Fi Channel, MSNBC, and more than 60 TV shows to promote his books and his research. Nick has also lectured on the UFO subject both in the UK and abroad. His latest book is Memoirs of a Monster Hunter. His website is located at www.nickredfern.com. The ATS Mix is proud and honored to have with us Nick Redfern. Hi, Nick. How are you?
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Hey, we're doing great, brother. Thanks for joining us this evening.
No, sure. No problem at all.
You know, John, why don't you get started?
Well, sure. I guess what a lot of our listeners would want to know is, what on earth are you doing here in the U.S.?
That's a question I often get asked when they hear me start talking.
I told Johnny, hell, I could have just gone over there to your house. We're next door neighbors almost. Yeah, and he could have called us at your home, and we could have just given him a dual interview.
He could have kind of shouted out the window or something like that. Done it that way.
Yeah, we'd let the members decide which one of us is from the United Kingdom.
Yeah, that wouldn't be too difficult. Whereabouts in Dallas are you?
I live in Garland.
Oh, well, you know where we're on White Rock Lake.
Oh, yeah, you're over, yeah, sure, of course, you know.
We're just by the lights at Garland and Buckner.
Yeah, Garland and Buckner, yeah. Uh-huh. Man, we're not 10 minutes from each other.
Yeah. Well, actually, my wife's from Texas. She's from the town of Port Arthur in southeast Texas.
Right.
And we've kind of split our time over the last 7 years since we've been married between England and America. We first were in the U.S. for a while in Port Arthur, then moved up to Dallas, then went back to England for a couple of years, and now we're back in Dallas. So we kind of like tend to travel around a little bit, and which is, you know, the way we like it. But so right now, as I said, we're back in Dallas, and not too far, you know, from where you are, which is kind of fun and strange at the same time. So.
Yeah, it really is. Well, you know, before we get started into this, and we got a buttload of questions. That's a technical term. They may not have that term over there in the United Kingdom. But we got a buttload of questions we want to ask. But the first thing I got to ask you, Nick, honestly, is when you were a kiddo, what really got you interested in what would become your passion, if you will?
Yeah. Well, you mentioned, you know, in my introduction when you started, how I got interested back in the late 70s. And, yeah, at that time, I was literally, you know, just, I don't even think I was a teenager. I was maybe 11, something like that. And the reason and how I got involved is that my dad was in the British Royal Air Force. He worked on radar.
Really?
And, yeah. He was in the radar, in the Royal Air Force in the 1950s, and that was his speciality that he was trained in. And he was involved in several incidents in the early 50s, specifically 1952, where some of the guys were on radar duty in the early hours of one particular morning and tracked these very, very fast moving objects, very high flying objects over the English North Sea. And bearing in mind the time frame, the first thought was, well, is this the Russians launching a sneak attack? And even though that was the first thought, it was quite clear that these things were, you know, traveling at speeds that far exceeded anything that the Russians or the British or the Americans had at that time.
Right.
So aircraft were scrambled from a nearby Air Force base. The pilots basically couldn't get close to these things at all. And they kind of played like a game of cat and mouse with the air crews through the night. And this actually went on for several days, and eventually everybody was sworn to secrecy, told not to talk about it. The radar tapes were impounded, and my dad didn't say anything to me, or to anybody, I should say, till the late 1970s. He just kept it to himself and then related it to me, and that really got me interested, I suppose, in the subject, you know, from the idea that I've been like the average person, I suppose, at 11 years of age, not really paying much attention to it. But then when you find your own member of your own family who's trained to know what goes on in our skies and work for the military, then that, I think, really opened, you know, my eyes as to the fact that, wow, something is going on. And I began subscribing to some of the old newsletters and self-published magazines that existed back in England then, and going to conferences and lectures and just getting to know people in the subject. And I suppose it sort of spiraled from there, really.
Wow.
That's very interesting. Hey, listen, I understand you've done an intense investigation in the famous incident that happened in 1947. Of course, I'm talking about Roswell. Mm. What did you find in your investigation and from what you heard from the military whistleblowers?
Well, you know, that book, Body Snatchers in the Desert, is probably the most controversial book I've ever written, and it kind of made me the bad guy of ufology for about 2 years, which was fine. You know, I don't have a problem with it. But basically, my view, and, you know, some people thought I'd change my views on the whole UFO subject, which I haven't. You know, that's just complete nonsense. What happened was that, you know, Roswell, I think in everybody's mind, is one of the sort of the key cases of the entire UFO subject. And in the period from roughly, I think it was 96 through till 2003, I interviewed various old-timers from the military and the intelligence community, about 9 or 10 in total, and of that 9 or 10, 5 or 6 who are willing to be interviewed for the book. And they said to me that, you know, nothing of a UFO nature crashed at Roswell, that what actually came down were, or the legend, if you like, was the result of various high-altitude balloon experiments using human beings in things like cosmic ray and high-altitude exposure balloon experiments. Now, what I did was to publish the story of what I was told. However, I wasn't dogmatic about it in terms of, you know, as I've always said, people have said to me, how do you know you weren't lied to and fed disinformation? And my answer has always been, well, that could well be the case. You know, I don't dispute that possibility. But I've always been of the opinion that when it comes to any aspect of the UFO subject, to try and fully understand where the truth is or where the truth lies, we need to examine all the evidence, not just that which, you know, suits us or which sounds good and that, you know, goes along with what we need or want to hear. So I basically took the decision to say, hey, this is what these guys told me, and put the story out there for everybody to see. So it wasn't like a debunking enterprise. It was really, this is what I've been told. Can we validate it, or can somebody come forward and say, hey, you know, this is actually disinformation because I was part of the project that put it together.
Right.
So that was basically the idea behind that book. But some people did get the idea that, you know, I'd either been paid off by the CIA to say this, or, you know, I was in league with the Men in Black or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
But the truth it was, you know, I just feel that if information comes our way and it comes from significant sources on the inside, it's our duty to put it all out there so as a community we can discuss it and try and determine what's going on, basically. So
right.
That was the thrust of the book, so to speak.
Well, I can recall a while back, and I'm probably wrong on this, and I'm going to sound pretty crazy if I am wrong in this, but did I read somewhere where someone told you at one time that they thought these vehicles were piloted by Japanese POWs or possibly by victims of a diabolical human experiment?
Well, it wasn't so much piloted. What it was, there's no doubt that in the period of the late 1940s in New Mexico, there were a lot of balloon experiments going on, and some of these balloon experiments were based around trying to determine what would happen to a human being if they were put in a balloon and sent to a very high altitude, and they're trying to determine how the human body reacts to high altitudes and high pressures.
Right.
Because obviously, you know, this was way before even supersonic flight, manned space flight, and things like this. There wasn't a great deal known about how the human body would be affected in the higher echelons of the atmosphere, if you like. And the story I was told was that to avoid, if you like, any harm coming to U.S. citizens, that various Japanese prisoners of war brought to the U.S. were used in these high-altitude balloon experiments. But it wasn't a case of them piloting them. It was, according to the story I was told, they were placed in gondola-type devices, flown to very high altitudes, and when they came down, they would then test the people to see how their blood and oxygen
right.
levels and et cetera had been affected by high-altitude exposure. I mean, I think there's a good possibility that there were several things going on that, you know, that could well have been dark and dubious government experiments going on at the same time that unknown UFOs were actually watching our scientific advances in that same area. There could have been, you know, several things going on that could have led to the Roswell legend that might actually ironically have involved, you know, us and them, so to speak.
Well, you know what I find amazing is the further we get into this century, more and more people seem to be coming out of the woodwork, if you will, or out of the closet,
yeah.
in the case of some U.S. senators. Example, Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter professes without any way, shape, form, or fashion that he has seen a UFO. You have documentation after documentation of more and more people that are not so much concerned anymore about the stigma, if you will, of being a UFO sighter. I'm just curious, did you ever have any personal experiences along the way?
You mean sightings myself?
Yeah, yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. No, unfortunately, I guess I'm one of those people who's still looking. But, I mean, in saying that, I don't get discouraged purely because there are, as you said, a lot of credible people. There's also a good body of official documentation that makes it very clear in my mind that particularly in the 40s and 50s, there were things flying around the whole world that, you know, far outweighed anything that the most advanced air forces at the time were flying. So I don't doubt for 1 minute. So yeah, if there wasn't, granted, if there wasn't that evidence, you know, I'd be in kind of two minds. Collectively, when you put together the credible witness testimony, the pilot reports, radar reports, official documents that have now been declassified, I don't think there's any doubt that something very, very weird's going on. It's just a, you know, a matter of trying to determine, I guess, what they want and where they're from.
I know that many of our listeners know about the famous Roswell incident, but you investigated another incident that happened in the UK that involved, I guess, a UFO crash back in 1964. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about that incident and what you found?
Yeah, this is a really weird case. There are probably, I think, somewhere in the region of maybe 10 or 11 reports on record in England, which could broadly be termed, I suppose, British Roswells. You know, the idea that some sort of weird craft crashed and the government covered it up, basically. And one of the more interesting ones occurred, it's either in February or March of 64, it's a little bit unclear as to exactly when, but this story was first published in a status report, as it was called at the time, by Leonard Stringfield in 1991. And Stringfield was a pioneering American researcher into the field of crash retrievals, and he put this story out about how a UFO had supposedly crashed in a large area of forest in central England called the Cannock Chase. Now, what was ironic, or is still ironic, I suppose, is that the Cannock Chase actually situated only literally about a 15-minute drive from where I used to live in England. And it's a very, very large, densely forested area. And myself and a colleague began looking into this particular story and placed adverts in local newspapers, wrote letters to the newspapers asking if anybody was involved or recalled this case from 64, could they come forward and tell us? This was round about 1996 when we put these ads out there and these inquiries to see if anybody knew anything about it. And one guy did, a guy named Harold South. And Harold first contacted us by letter to tell us how he'd been driving through the woods early one particular spring, late winter morning, February-ish, 64. He said he'd come across this police/military cordon deep in the woods, and the military had basically stopped him in his vehicle and said, no, you need to turn around and find an alternative road. He realized something was going on because there was some sort of large military transporter type vehicle parked at the edge of this particular field. So what he did, he turned around, went up the road, and when he was out of sight of the military, he pulled to one side, pulled his vehicle undercover, basically, and headed on foot through the woods to a clearing where he saw all this military activity going on. And he said he saw the military loading what he described as a small, probably about 15 to 20 foot long, triangular-shaped object with no sign of wings or a cockpit or wheels or anything like that, no fuselage, just like a pure, almost like out of a mold, triangular-shaped object being loaded onto this transporter vehicle. Well, he got out the area as quickly as possible, but it seems evident that somebody had taken his license plate down, and he was later visited at his home by the local police and asked why he was out in the area and what he was doing walking through the woods. And it was he was practically, you know, intimidated to not talk about it.
Sure.
And he certainly didn't. As I said, it was 22 years after this occurred that he spoke with us. Now, what happened was that myself and this colleague, Irene Bott, who used to run a group called the Staffordshire UFO Group, we telephoned Harold from my house early one morning, probably about 9 o'clock, 8 o'clock, something like that, and said, we'll be over to see you to do a first-hand personal interview in roughly 45 minutes or an hour, something like that anyway. By the time we got there, his mood and his manner had completely changed, and he was very reluctant to say anything. And we asked him, well, you know, what's changed in that hour? And he said, at first he wouldn't say anything. And then eventually he said, well, you know, since you called and in between you arriving, I got this phone call from the Ministry of Defense, basically the British Ministry of Defense, kind of like the equivalent of the Pentagon or the Department of Defense over here.
Right.
Warning him not to talk about this case under any circumstances. And I mean, myself and Irene, we looked at each other and thought, well, you know, is the guy a fantasist? Is he just trying to hoax us? And so we said to him, is the call that you've just received from them the last incoming call? And he said, yes. So what we did was to dial 1471, which is the equivalent of the system you have over here, so you can get the last incoming number if it hasn't been blocked. So we did that, and sure enough, it was actually a military operator whose job it was to channel calls between military establishments and the general public, and it thereby allows the military, the originating base, to withhold its number, and everything just channeled through the operator number.
Right.
So we spoke to the operator, who eventually agreed to transfer us to the originating office, and it turned out to be a division of the Ministry of Defence called the Guard Service at a place called Whittington Army Barracks, which was about 15 miles from where he lived. So we had this bizarre situation where this now elderly guy in his 70s, who was, I mean, his job was a washing machine repairer. He didn't have any job in the military or anything.
Right.
And when he was crossing the Canachase Woods, he was actually going to repair somebody's washing machine. So, you know, he's just unfortunately in the wrong place at the wrong time. But this kind of spelled out to all three of us, I think, that either his telephone or our telephone, my telephone at the time, was being monitored in some fashion by the military, and that this was a plan initiated to try and intimidate him into not speaking to us, you know, in between us speaking to him and on the phone and arriving at his house. And that was probably one of the more intriguing cases, where there's no doubt in my mind that something not only very unusual crashed, but 22 years later, the military was still sufficiently concerned by the case to still keep it under wraps and I guess undermine the witness as well.
Sure.
Well, that was kind of one of the stranger ones I've been involved
in.
Right.
Well, you know, I'm a big James Bond fan and have always been very intrigued of the world of MI6. Mm. And I was just curious. So we did an interview recently with Stanton Freeman, and I noticed in my research that he had reviewed, some things for you, some of your writings or whatever. But regarding MJ-12 documents, okay, people believe they're real. Some people don't believe they're real. What's your stance on the MJ-12 documents? Do you still believe that they are documents like the MJ-12s and that maybe they're a product of disinformation?
Well, I think the biggest problem with the MJ-12 documents isn't so much what they say. It's the fact that for 99.9% of what we've got, at least, that everything we have is pretty much a photocopy. You know, we don't have access, for the most part, to original documentation that can be forensically analyzed. Yes, we have photocopies, which in some cases we can tell for certain were done with vintage 1940s and 50s typewriters. But then the skeptics say, well, anyone can get an old typewriter and type something out, which in some respects is true. I think, personally, I think the MJ-12 documents are so detailed that I rule out the possibility of, you know, just some spotty-faced teenager in his bedroom, you know, copying and pasting them in some sort of, you know, computer program or whatever. I rule that out. But so I think either they're the product of disinformation to lead us away from the truth, or possibly towards the truth, you know, maybe it's like a sympathetic insider, or they are the literal truth. I think it has to be one of those two areas. But I think the problem is why, though, it's been at such a stalemate situation is because, you know, we can't go to an archive and examine MJ-12 documents. They're just literally something that is sent through the mail anonymously, and we have to take it on the word of the sender that what they're sending us is photocopies of real material, you know, copied in the Pentagon or the DOD or wherever.
Right.
So I think, you know, as much as I would love to say that, yes, I think these are the real thing, I just don't know, because I think we're just not in a position to forensically have enough data to say so.
Right.
And I think, unfortunately, it's like with Roswell. The further time goes on, and unfortunately the passage of time, you know, people get old and they die. Every year that goes by, we're getting less and less people we can speak to. And, you know, the less people that are, the more the secret gets buried. And I think that goes for MJ-12 as well as Roswell, that the people who may have been in the know years ago that possibly may even, you know, have even stolen documents and kept them in the attic or whatever and now deciding to release them. Obviously, they're going to be dwindling in number as well. So, but I think my conclusion would be whether they're real or disinformation, I still think there's no doubt that they come from an official body somewhere.
And you know what's it's interesting that you say that, because you said something earlier that I really have to totally 1,000% agree with, when you said that it's either disinformation or someone's trying to lead us to a bigger truth, maybe. And two prime examples I can think of, one reality and one maybe fantasy, but the reality one would be what happened during Nixon's administration with Deep Throat. And All the President's Men, which is heralded as the movie depiction of that event. Deep Throat was constantly trying to guide the editors and all the people that were involved in the investigation process to the truth, which they eventually found out. Now, on the fantasy side, X-Files to me was just a phenomenal series in that a lot of the things that they put on the show every Friday night or Sunday night or whenever, you know, it eventually landed, there was a lot of things in there that a year or two later even, all of a sudden, are reality, you know? Yeah. And so you start to think, well, my Lord, I mean, either they're clairvoyant or they're being given some information and saying, this might be an interesting story or whatever. Yeah. And the reason why I'm bringing all this up is there are several movie producers, television producers, that go to AboveTopSecret.com. We know this for a fact. They go to the site, they see things that the membership is talking about or whatever, and all of a sudden it's on either, some TV show, whether it be Lost, whether it be 24, whether it be Heroes. You know, I mean, it's just an amazing journey of secrets. I mean, does that blow you away?
Well, not really. I think, I think when information's out there, inevitably when you have something like the internet that wasn't around sort of 15 years ago, it becomes very, very easy to access information. I think that works both ways in terms of whether it's people in the entertainment industry, film and TV people, or the government knowing what we're doing, because it's easy to access because it's all online, and vice versa. You know, it's quite easy to track down retired military people if you've got their name. You know, you do a white pages search or a yellow pages search or whatever. And I think so it works, it goes both ways. And I think, when ideas are out there in a medium that's so accessible like the internet, I don't think it's that surprising that, this sort of thing can happen and probably does happen quite regularly.
Right.
I want to kind of move into a different area if we could, because I understand it also is an area that you're very fond of. I understand that cryptozoology is a field of study that you're interested in. If I recall correctly, you did some investigations about some chupacabras, I believe, that were in Puerto Rico back in the mid-1990s. What did you find out about those chupacabras?
Yeah, I guess cryptozoology is actually probably a bigger interest of mine than the UFO subject. I think the main reason being is because it's one that gives you the opportunity to sort of really get out there and go on expeditions, and look for these things. Cryptozoology being the study of unknown animals like Bigfoot, the Yeti, the Loch Ness Monster, etc. And you mentioned the chupacabras. It's sort of been since the mid-1990s that this weird creature has been reported on the island of Puerto Rico, which is basically described as being something like a monkey-like body with large bat-like wings. In some cases, it's reported with glowing red eyes and some razor-sharp claws and fangs. And I've made two expeditions to Puerto Rico, one in 2004, one in 2005, for collectively about 3 weeks or so. And spoke to a lot of people on the island, witnesses to this creature, and whatever it is, there's no doubt in my mind that it exists. A lot of people, for example, when I was visiting the island, were of the opinion that it was connected with a lot of UFO sightings that have certainly been made on the island and in the same vicinity where the chupacabras has been seen. For example, there's been a lot of reports near the coastal parts of the island of very, very large black triangular-shaped UFOs coming out of the water. And a lot of these chupacabra sightings and attacks on animals in the area have been reported in precisely these same areas. Other people I spoke with thought it was some sort of like a surviving dinosaur, you know, that just hadn't become extinct. And other people took the view that it was kind of like a supernatural demonic type creature that had been, you know, summoned up by occult groups and things like that. So there was like a widespread variation in theories and ideas, but, you know, whatever it is, there's no doubt in my mind it exists. I also interviewed a lot of veterinarians and actually people with the civil defense unit who'd gone out and investigated Chupacabra's attacks, where farmers and ranchers, their animals, if you like, had been attacked by this creature and literally had the classic vampire-like two puncture marks on the neck and blood drained from the bodies. And, you know, they were absolutely convinced that this was sort of, you know, a weird animal of some type, you know, whether it was ours, theirs, or what it was. I think that's sort of still open to question.
Does anybody ever claim that they have, like, the skeletal remains of one of these animals?
Well, I mean, I did uncover several rumors, and I heard these on a number of occasions from completely separate people, you know, didn't even know each other when I was on the island. There was a story which I heard both in 2004 and 2005, and I'm due to go back next year and investigate these again. The story was that supposedly, at some point in the late 1990s, at a military base that used to exist on the island but that's now closed, called Roosevelt Roads, but supposedly a number of Chupacabras live creatures were captured in the El Yunque rainforest by, I suppose, the equivalent of like a Delta Force team, and placed in cages, taken to this military base, and then transferred back to the United States. You know, this story was prevalent in all across the island. Different people knew different aspects of it.
Right.
So, you know, if this is one that, you know, there's a credible one, and I think it is credible in terms of the fact that a lot of people knew about it. So it obviously had some sort of, you know, originating story. I think this is one that could potentially, you know, be a good one. You can well imagine that regardless of whatever the creature's origins are, to get your hands on some sort of razor-sharp killing machine is going to be in the interest of any military. If you
sure.
can tame it and, you know, tame it and unleash it on the battlefield or whatever,
of course.
It's going to do a hell of a lot of damage. So, you know, I mean, that is probably the closest I've got to the idea that, you know, Chupacabra's bodies and recoveries, that sort of thing. So,
well, you know, you mentioned something that I want to kind of elaborate on a little bit, and it's kind of a two-parter, but you can spend as much time on each one as you want to. One is, John and I have done several interviews where we're talking about Sasquatch and mm-hmm. Bigfoot. I'm just curious, is there one or any reported sightings in the United Kingdom of a Bigfoot?
There certainly is. I wrote a whole book about that called Man Monkey. Man Monkey, yeah. That's, the reason why it's called Man Monkey is because in the 1800s, in the central part of England, in a lot of the big woods around there, there were sightings of this weird, hairy, man-like creature. And at the time, sort of about 140 years ago, it became known throughout all the little local villages and hamlets and towns as the Man Monkey. That's what it was called.
Wow.
And now Britain has sort of a long history of sightings of these creatures. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that they think of things like Bigfoot and they think of the Pacific Northwest, or they think of the Yeti and the Himalayas, etc.
Right.
But Britain, the British stories are kind of odd because a lot of them have almost like a paranormal angle to them. And a lot of cryptozoologists like to purely stay in like the physical flesh and blood realm, if you like. But when you look at a lot of the British reports, we find a lot of sightings of these giant, hairy, man-like creatures in the vicinity of ancient stone circles like Stonehenge, or in the vicinity of ancient prehistoric burial mounds, places like that. And, you know, you would imagine if these were just purely physical animals, they would just be seen at random. And of course, you know, Britain's not a big country. It's got a population of 60 million, but it's quite small. And the idea that there could be this sort of relic, I guess, tribe of these creatures hiding out
right. Almost
defies belief in the sense of, well, why don't they get hit by a car occasionally or just found?
Right.
And there have been some weird cases where, for example, people have been driving home late at night through the woods and they've seen this creature crossing the road at maybe a distance of 100 yards, and as they've closed in, the headlights and their engine of the car has failed.
Right.
You know, almost if there's some really weird aspects to these cases. So what I did was to write this book and interview various people for this book, Man Monkey, and present all the evidence. And I think whatever the British Bigfoot is, if it's flesh and blood, there's more to it going on than that. You know, whether it has extraordinary other capabilities, you know, like sixth senses or extraordinary mental capabilities, maybe, I don't know. But it's not just some sort of dumb, lumbering ape wandering around. I think there's more significance to it than that.
Well, I hope so.
Because you definitely spend a lot of time researching and writing books about it. In fact, I was just looking by, what was it, 2004, Three Men Seeking Monsters, Six Weeks in Pursuit of Werewolves, Lake Monsters, Giant Cats, Ghostly Devil Dogs, and Ape Men. Tell us a little bit about what you found about werewolves. Are there werewolves?
Well, you know, people often ask me that when they find out I'm quite interested in stories of werewolves. And, you know, if people ask me, I tell them honestly, I don't think the whole idea of, like, the Hollywood image of a guy sprouting fangs for Howling at the Moon at the sight of the full moon,
right,
you know, is real.
Right.
However, in saying that, if people ask me, are there a lot of reports on file of people seeing wolf-like creatures, but, you know, walking like upright men? There are. There's no doubt about that. You know, from America, from England, from Europe, there's countless reports. Now, again, a lot of these are also significant in the sense that many of them surface in the vicinity, again, in England, around stone circles. In America, for example, Linda Godfrey, a prolific author of werewolf books, she's found a lot of reports in the vicinity of old Native American burial grounds and places like that. So again, you know, I think somewhere there's an aspect of the paranormal involved in, you know, whatever these sort of werewolf creatures like creatures are. But the book you mentioned, Three Men Seeking Monsters, is basically a kind of like a road trip that me and two friends, John Downs and Richard Freeman, who run a mystery animal research group in England, basically sort of traveling around England on kind of like a Gonzo-style expedition and adventure, which somebody described quite accurately as the X-Files meets Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which was... which was pretty close to how it actually was. You know, we do serious investigations, but we like to have a good time in the process. And so we basically got a large camper vehicle and traveled around England investigating these things. And actually the first time I went to Puerto Rico, myself and one of the two guys in the three-man book, John Downs, he came with me and we just hired this cool little silver Jeep and jetted around the islands and the jungles of Puerto Rico, having a good time and investigating monsters. So, you know, you can have fun with it and hopefully and uncover some significant information as well.
Sure.
Of course.
Part of that was the ghostly devil dogs. This wouldn't by chance be any part of some legends that I've heard from years back about the black dogs, would it?
That's exactly what it's about, yeah. England has this long history of sightings of ghostly black dog style creatures, and you know, they don't look like kind of cuddly little dogs, you know, that you would put on your lap and pet at home. We're talking about things, we're talking about creatures that look like dogs, but in some cases almost like the size of a small pony.
Wow.
And they've been described as having glowing, self-illuminating red eyes. They vanish and appear in the blink of an eye, and they've been described as almost like a kind of Grim Reaper type creature, in the sense if you see them, either you or a member of your family is going to die. And the legends really began sort of in the 14, 15, 1600s in England. And they were seen as, you know, like a precursor to death if you see one of these things, like don't cross its path. But it was actually these early tales that led Conan Doyle, who created Sherlock Holmes, to write The Hound of the Baskervilles. He actually based the story on a lot of these old existing legends of these devil dogs, as they became known. And a lot of towns all throughout England have tales relating to these ghostly devil dogs, and that's why if you go to England and you travel around a lot of the English pubs, you'll see a lot of pubs named the Black Dog. And they're not actually just taken from the fact that somebody once owned a black dog in the town. They're taken from these old legends. So, you know, whenever I investigate these cases in Britain, I always find a good excuse to travel to all these pubs of that particular name. So.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure you probably saw the little snippet that has made the news round here where I guess the Japanese have invented a red glowish in the dark kitten.
Yes. Yeah, that's kind of strange. I mean,
well, if you want to know where your cat is, and the lights are out, call the Japanese.
That's right.
It kind of makes you wonder, you know, what's going to happen next.
Well, on that same note, Nick, I mean, we've seen I love the movies. You know, I'm a movie aficionado. I hate to read, Nick. I hate to tell you this. I'll never read any of your books, not because of anything.
He isn't lying.
I don't read. Sorry. If you have cliff notes, maybe. But I don't read. I like watching movies. I'm a movie person. Now, here's the thing. This question has to do with the fact that I have seen movie after movie, and science fiction is my forte. Okay? I love science fiction. I love espionage kind of movie fare. And without exception, you see movie after movie after movie after movie portraying some kind of secret experiments with animals or people that they're trying to turn into animals and stuff. Do you think that all the cryptological mysteries that are out there may be something to do with some clandestine government that's doing experiments and all of a sudden they escaped and all of a sudden they're out in the open?
No.
Well, that sucks. You could have gone with them.
Joking aside, I do think that government agencies know far more about some of these weird creatures than they let on. And I will tell you that every time I've been to Puerto Rico, I have heard a lot of stories about supposed U.S. Air Force and military research installations deep in the rainforest in Puerto Rico, where supposedly at some point in the late 80s and 90s, there were some weird experiments being done on monkeys that supposedly escaped into the rainforests, and it was shortly afterwards that these chupacabras attacks began. Now, I don't doubt possibly, you know, that some strange genetic experiments have been undertaken and could be responsible for some of these reports. I think that's possible. I think where I kind of draw the line is I don't think even today we have really the technical and medical capabilities to kind of mutate something like a chimpanzee into like a razor-clawed, you know, fanged bat-wing killing machine. I think, you know, that's kind of almost too sci-fi-like. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if, you know, some bizarre genetic experiments have been undertaken and could be responsible for some of these cases. I mean, kind of along the same path, I'll give you another example. There are stories, for example, from a lake in Wales called Lake Bala, where there were lake monster stories began to surface in the early part of the 20th century. And looking back at them now and having done research, various researchers have come to the conclusion that what was actually going on was that the British military was testing small submarine-type devices in the lake and were actually using the mythology of like a lake monster as a cover in case somebody saw one of these things surfacing, which, you know, would make a lot of sense.
Sure.
The idea, you know, you use a mythology or a piece of folklore to hide something you're doing, and you hide it under the cover of that bit of folklore. So I think in that respect, the government probably does know more about these creatures in the sense that it's exploited the mystery for its own ends. But I think, you know, maybe 100 years from now, but today, you know, could we create something like the chupacabras? I just think maybe that's, you know, a little bit too far out of our technology even now, maybe.
Sure. Well, it's about time for us to wrap things up here with our interview. Okay. But before we do, sir, let me ask you, amongst the myriads of wonderful books that you have out there, what is new on the horizon that you're writing right now in your arsenal to come?
Well, I'm working on two books right now. Well, actually three. One is a follow-on to my Memoirs of a Monster Hunter, which was basically sort of, again, like a road trip of me traveling around the U.S., investigating various weird creatures, and the one I'm working on now is a follow-on to that. I'm also doing one on alien abductions, but from the perspective of what the government might know about the subject and how they've investigated claims of alien abduction. And then I'm doing a regional book on mystery animals in the county of Staffordshire, England, where I grew up. So that's sort of going to keep me busy for about the next 6-7 months, maybe.
Well, we'll definitely be looking forward to them.
Okay, well, thanks. I appreciate it, guys.
Nick, we want you to hang on the line, if you would, because we're going to say our personal goodbyes to you off air. But we'd like to remind everybody about Nick's site. It has it's really a cool site, Nick. I got to give you some kudos on the thing. I really like the graphics and the artwork and all the other neat stuff. And it's got books that you have right out now. And, of course, some neat shortcuts, his bio, book reviews, links, blogs. And, of course, the most important one I'm sure Nick will point to is buy books now. but if you go to Nick's website at www.nickredfern.com, that's NICKREDFERN.com, we would really appreciate it. And I'm sure Nick and his wife would also. I mean, you know, it's getting more expensive to fly back to the UK, brother.
Yeah,
you know,
it's not cheap. They're sort of traveling the Atlantic and back.
Well, yeah, and my heart's with you on that trip. When I did the trip to Vietnam, that was like a 16-hour trip. How long does it take you from Dallas?
Well, generally, if you go from DFW Airport, you fly to Newark, which is about a 3.5-hour flight. Then you have about a 3-hour layover. Then it's about a 6-hour flight to Birmingham, which is the nearest city to where I used to live. So I guess altogether, with checking in at DFW, it's like 14 hours probably altogether. So when you get there, you're kind of like a zombie or whatever.
Yeah, and then when you arrive, you can go into your local pub and get a hot beer. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah,
I'm kidding.
Wake you up again.
I know. We found out several interviews ago. You guys got refrigerators now, so it's okay. Anyway,
we even have electric lights in cars.
What?
Oh my God!
Look at that! I can't believe. Well, you guys are really high tech now.
Yeah.
Anyway,
no more of those cobbled streets and Jack the Ripper type fogs or whatever.
I love the fact you don't have the gas lights anymore.
No, that's right. Yeah.
Anyway, you've been a real pal, Nick. We really appreciate the time.
Sure.
Here. Until next time, on behalf of the Above Network LLC, the AboveTopSecret.com membership and staff, this is Dave Rabbit.
And this is Johnny Anonymous. Thanks for joining us for this interview on the ATS Mix.
Dave Rabbit here again with the ATS Mix Show from AboveTopSecret.com. If you love politics and are tired of hearing and reading all that robotic crap that keeps churning out from the mainstream media, then come join me and thousands of people from around the world at AbovePolitics.com. They have political forums for everyone's taste, including U.S. politics, United Kingdom politics, Canadian politics, head-to-head political debates, politics of war. They have a general chit-chat and a freshman forum for you newbies and rookies to the political arena. There's also forums about Mideast conflict, socialism. They have a slugfest, liberalism, conservatism, moderate, and my personal favorite, military and security issues. So if you don't want to be another sheep and want to be a unique thinker, AbovePolitics.com is for you. Part of the Above Network LLC. Deny apathy. AbovePolitics.com.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com is over.
You've been listening to the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous. If you have a comment, suggestion, an opposing view, or would like to participate in a future show of ATS Mix, please contact Dave or Johnny at www.AboveTopSecret.com. The views expressed on ATS Mix do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of the Above Network LLC or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening. You may now reattach your tinfoil hat. We'll be right back.